You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. When we consider what happens to us when we pass, many people over the years have claimed to have had a glimpse of the other side. Near-death experiences have been investigated, collected, and discussed for several decades since the subject rose to prominence in the 1960s. For many in the field of psychiatry and neurology, there's nothing to them. Yet thousands claim to have experienced them. In their new book, Dying Light, An Investigation into Near-Death Experiences, Jason Hewlett and Peter Wren set out to find out just what is going on here. Jason joins me to discuss the book and the unexpected journey it took both he and Peter on as they speak to experiencers, researchers, and skeptics. It's a fascinating and thought-provoking book, and I was delighted to get a chance to speak with Jason, as you will hear shortly. Before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or clicking on the Patreon link in the show notes. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, bonus content, early releases, and more. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms: Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, updates, and merchandise. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. What happens when we pass is still the most baffling question that many of us have. But myself and Jason will try to shed some light and positivity. Join us. This week, it's a warm welcome back to paranormal investigator and author Jason Hewlett. His latest book, written in conjunction with his colleague Peter Wren, delves into a subject that often perplexes many: near-death experiences. Dying Light is a thought-provoking book that pulls the subject of NDEs back into focus. Jason, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Paul. I've been looking forward to this since we set it up, which feels like a month ago. So
yes,
it's been a long time coming again.
Yes, finally glad to speak to you again, as always. It's a pleasure. A pleasure.
Well, it's been a while. I think it's been a good year or more or longer since the last time we talked. So well, yeah, no, it's great, Paul.
Time is a strange concept in these post-pandemic days. Jason, I think
it is, isn't it? It feels like the last 2 years just almost collapsed in on themselves in weird ways, but the world's still very different. So I don't know quite how to react to the modern times.
Yeah. It feels like we're living through one of those post-apocalyptic documentaries where people say, oh, everything's changed, but things are still the same. And you kind of think, well, what do they mean? And then you go through something as traumatic as everybody has. And then you think, now I fully understand what they meant now.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Especially in the current climate and everything that we've gone on. I think this is one of those subjects that's probably been close to people's thoughts and hearts for a lot of us. Some people have suffered some traumatic losses over the last couple of years through what's gone on in every country in the world, Jason. So it seems, without wishing to sound churlish, it seems like it's one of those books that's been born and released at the right time, because I think for a lot of us, the concept of our own mortality and our place in the world has really come into focus for a lot of us more than I think we normally used to think about, especially in the Western hemisphere, in regards to how we deal with death and the conversations of death and how it affects us. Because as we were talking before we started, it's still, for many on our side of the world, a very taboo personal subject, isn't it?
Well, it is. And it's something we were talking about before we went live here, is that people in the West just don't like to address death at all. Like, it's not even called a funeral anymore. It's a celebration of life, right? Like, we're so afraid of our own mortality, and we're chasing, posthumous fame, so we'll be remembered forever. when it doesn't matter. Like one day, you and me and everyone we know is going to die, and there's nothing we can do about that, and we can't change that. So I think people need to embrace that concept more, if that makes sense. And I think, but people don't want to, and that's why like near-death experiences, even ghosts and hauntings and the paranormal, I think freaks people out so much. A certain part of the population is they just don't want to have to deal with any of the thoughts that their life could end and they'll be transitioning to something somewhere else, or maybe nothing. And I think the book really hit a nerve that way. I think you're right. Like it came out right at the tail end of all this, really. And I think our mortality is in a lot of people's minds. Like, well said.
I think these are important questions, though, I think, because as I've spoken recently to your fellow country person, Morgan Knudsen, on another episode, we were talking about this whole aspect of the paranormal, the investigations that have gone over generations and the latter part of a century, at least, that for many people, this is the most important question, I think, Jason, for a lot of people, is what happens next? What is there? Where do we go? Why do we go? What happens to us? Because for a lot of people who dive into these subjects, we always come across the concept of human beings basically being batteries that were just energy. And so as anybody with a brief knowledge of physics will understand, energy can't be destroyed. It just changes into something else. It has to go somewhere. I think when we start to look into the whole concept of the paranormal and hauntings and ghosts and voices from the other side and EVPs and things like that, for many people, I think the concept of being a ghost is probably as frightening as passing on, because it leaves as many unanswered questions as it raises, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's something too, as we get older, we start asking those questions more and more. I mean, I just turned 50 this year.
Yes, I'm not far behind you.
Yeah, right. it's just more on the forefront of your mind. Like, what happens next? Is this it?
Mm.
But I one of the theories that Peter and I deal with the paranormal and ghost hunting is much like what you say, we are made of energy, and that energy has to go somewhere. It doesn't just disappear. And then therefore, can that energy be like recorded somewhere or live on in some form? As a spirit or a residual haunting, et cetera. So I think, I just think this is a big topic. It's a controversial topic, and even sort of putting the book together, like we got various different points of view that come across in the book. And Peter and I thought it was important to make sure all those were there so people could kind of make up their own minds. And I know when those ideas were shared with other people who were in the book, some didn't like the fact that, you know, we were showing two sides to the story. But I mean, that's just the way it goes. You can't do a thorough investigation of something and not show all sides and all opinions and beliefs. As a journalist, someone who's a journalist for 10 years, that's just ingrained in my thought process, no matter what. You have to be both a believer and a skeptic at the same time with this subject matter. And we really wanted to put that across in hope of maybe making it easier for readers too. You know what I mean? So they don't have to feel like they're just being fed this one idea. And I hope that comes across that way. That was our hope. And I hope that makes it even more engaging for readers.
Absolutely. I think one of the great strengths of this book is exactly what you've referred to there, because it doesn't shy away from the friction that this subject causes. Because as with any aspect of paranormal, there will always be people who are entrenching their belief through whatever system they come from, be it a religious background, be it a animistic background, be it a skeptical background. They will have a preconceived idea of bias. And I think it would have been far easier for yourself and Peter to have fallen onto one side of this argument, to pander to that particular crowd, rather than do what you've done in your previous works, both with your documentaries and YouTube shows that you've done and the earlier book, Jason, in the fact that you've presented a balanced approach to it, where, as you say, some people won't be happy the fact that they're rubbing shoulders with people who absolutely fundamentally disagree with their point of view on every level.
Well, that's kind of the world we're in too, isn't it?
Yes.
Can't agree to disagree anymore. People just don't. They just want their opinion to be validated, and that's it, and to hell with everybody else and what they think. But that's not how life works, the world works, society works. And I think we got to get back to understanding that. If we're going to have any worthwhile dialogue on any subject matter, let alone the paranormal, right? Like, there's a time when you could just sit and argue points and ideas, and that would be okay, and everyone would walk away happy. But we just can't seem to do that now. But Peter and I refuse to pander to any side in our work at all. And that's kind of what we pride ourselves on. And we refuse to just bow to anyone that doesn't like that idea.
I found it quite interesting that you guys had decided to go down this particular subject matter, because as we've touched on, this is an extremely divisive subject, whichever side of the argument you want to come at it across. And it's probably one of the most entrenched ideas that people come across when it comes to the world of the paranormal. I think along with sort of things like spontaneous human combustion and EVPs, that it's either real or it's just gobbledygook in some people's opinions. It's just nonsensical that any of this could be real. And yet, as with any of these topics, Jason, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people that will hand on their heart say that they have had a near-death experience. And there are probably as many people that will say a variety of explanations for what these people believe they've gone through. So when you came to look at the topic of this new book, was that something that you kind of attacked with some relish, that this was a subject that was so controversial? Or did you just think, because of Peter's previous personal experiences and the conversations you've had with other people throughout your life, both work and in the field of the paranormal, did you think it was something that you really wanted just to do because you were very interested in what on earth was happening for some people?
Yeah, it was more of that. I mean, Peter had shared his story with me. And then when we were writing An Investigator's Archive, our second book, we interviewed Angela Artuso, who's interviewed in this book. She was in the chapter The Man in Black. And she told us that story when we were just talking to her about her career as a paranormal investigator. And it was like, it was so like profound and shocking and frightening an encounter. And it didn't really fit within it, to fit it within just her story. Her other story is just why she was a ghost hunter. It would have got kind of lost. And I remember after we talked to her and I phoned Peter and I'm like, Peter, we got to write a book about this. Like, this is just this is just fascinating. And her story is so different than a lot of people's near-death experiences, including Peter's. And he's like, yeah, for sure. So, I mean, we pitched it, you know, to Shannon LeGros and G. Michael Hoff at Beyond the Fray, who we publish our books through, and they liked the idea. So we just decided, let's just do it and then go and find as many people who had these experiences as we can, interview them, and then even just try to balance that out by talking, you know, to like a grief counselor and then someone like Lynn Russell, who's researched near-death experiences, and find some scientists, et cetera, and then just kind of put it out there. So it was more, we didn't really care about the controversy at that point. We just thought it was really interesting and wanted to do something about it. And I mean, there'd been lots of books out there on near-death experiences, but we wanted to just kind of, as everything came together, do it a bit different and show, like we do, the two sides to the story, share both the believers and the non-believers' points of view to try to just give it some balance. So that's really how that idea germinated. And it went really fast once we started. Like, I think like the second book had just come out and we started work on Dying Light, like right after, like right before Halloween of 2021.
Yeah.
So there's no real break even between editing and releasing one book and moving into this one. It just happened that quick because the ball had just started rolling.
Did you find it was a subject that some people were really uncomfortable talking about or opening up about what they'd been through or what they believed had happened to them? Or with your experience and the people that you've got to know through both of your work in the paranormal, Jason, is this a subject for those people that believe that they have had a near-death experience? They find it very easy to be honest about it, whether you believe them or not.
Yeah, no, people were more than willing to talk. Like, that's actually what was really interesting is people, it almost like they were so excited to share their story and you know, but their beliefs that they were born out of it, that it was very easy to find people to interview. Which surprised me because sometimes, like, you know, as you know, Paul, like at least for the longest time, if you wanted to talk about ghosts with anyone or ask them if they had an experience, nobody wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, they just didn't want to be viewed as flaky or weird or anything.
Yeah.
But I think because of what had happened to our whole planet the last 2 years, there's very much a rise in spirituality and a desire to find out if there is more to life than just this society that we built up and then almost crumbled because of a virus. I think people are looking for more in their lives. And this was a great opportunity for those people to share it and share their point of view. Because as you find the book, and I know there's our encounters to the contrary, but for the most part, people who have these near-death experiences come back very changed and they believe for the better, with a much more optimistic worldview or view of things and more optimistic view of our purpose here on this planet. So I thought that was really interesting how easy it actually was once you talked to them, got a hold of people, for them to actually tell you their story and not shy away from it and tell you in great detail too, as some of the stories were in the book.
Hmm. Were you surprised at how positive most people who've had a near-death experience view it, Jason? Because I think what I've always found odd, and I'm certainly no expert in this field at all, but I've read enough and heard enough people who have claimed to have had these experiences, that the number of negative ones I've ever come across, I would say are in quite a small percentage of the overall volume of experiences that I've heard or read about. And yet, I'm not sure if it's just my perception in the modern era. There seems to be this perception that near-death experiences are a very traumatic experience for a lot of people. And yet, when you read the book and everybody you speak to, when they come back from wherever they go, a lot of them seem to have a real zest for life. They understand that they want to live every day as if that's their last, that they want to achieve more, be more, love more, be more open. Was that something that surprised you, or as in myself, is it something that, because of your experience and your knowledge in the field, you weren't particularly surprised until you started to hear more and more people say just what a positive experience it was, regardless of how traumatic the event may sound?
Yeah, no, it was like I was not surprised, but then I was, if that makes sense. Because I remember talking to one person and it was this positive experience. I thought, okay, because I'd heard that, right? That people do have these positive experiences. But then, and we interviewed, oh, geez, how many people in that book that had them? Like a good dozen or so, 12, 14 people. To have that many people have a positive experience, I thought that was just like, oh, okay. Like everybody did, even though, you know, they nearly died and in some cases nearly froze to death on the side of a mountain or drowned in a lake or what have you. But they were like, you know, even all these years later after these experiences, like, yeah, no, I'm ready. Like if this is it, I'm okay. I'm okay to go there because I know that what's on the other side is just so much better and more full of peace and love. And this was a learning experience, basically, is what life was really there for, almost like a training ground for the next step. So yeah, I was quite shocked. I know there are people who've had negative experiences. And we're even kicking around ideas to write a second book and kind of maybe shine some light on those more.
Mm-hmm.
Plus kind of touch into the whole alien abduction connection that people seem to bring up with these and talk more into past lives. But I think I found it inspiring that these many people could essentially, as far as they are concerned, die and come back and not be fearful or resentful. And in fact, just embrace life more. I thought that was amazing to have that happen for whatever reason. And it just, I don't know, gave me hope that, you know, death isn't that scary a concept really, is if it's that good, you know what I mean? Is that profound? It's like, so what's the problem? Like, you know, I was quite surprised by that. And I hope that's a takeaway when people read the book, is that this is not something to be afraid of. It's just a natural progression and it's a really beautiful experience in the end.
I think what I took away from reading the experiences, relaying their stories and their sights and sounds and conversations they even had as they drift off wherever. Because this is the other aspect of all this. It would be very easy, because often when we talk about these concepts in modern culture, there is often this argument that is so well known, it's ingrained in anybody that's into the paranormal, that people have a rounded view of what to expect, or they've kind of, it's a one size fits all, Jason. And yet, the more you read, I think the more unique experiences you stumble across, they're not all the same. It's not all floating into lights. It's not all relatives coming to guide them or speak to them or take them back or whatever. There are numerous different scenarios, and sometimes people have conversations with people they've no idea who they're talking to, or they're floating into places that they've got no, it means nothing to them, and yet they still have this positive, warm response to it.
Well, I think that was the biggest thing that surprised me, is how the experiences can be so similar yet so subjective based on their life experience. You know, people like Dan Gagnon, having growing up Catholic, his experience, he met someone who very much seemed to be Jesus Christ. That makes sense, right?
Mm.
Yet someone else, like in Peter's case, even like he met a figure that he felt was his grandfather, who he had never met.
Mm.
But he knew that that's what it was, even though he couldn't see it. And you know, Paul Drake being in a garden of all places, right? But his dad comes and stops him from walking through the garden gate to who knows what, saying this is not your time. Like, I think that's just, to me, was just almost the biggest shock of all. It was just how different, you know, Marlene having, you know, drowning, but it's just basically like this rainbow of light coming through the water. I thought it was just really, I don't want to say crazy how different they all were, but it was just, to me, shocking how varied these experiences were, yet there was still the same positive outcome to them.
Hmm.
And some seemed to vary in length too, like Scott Taylor and, you know, Peter Panagore. For them, it felt like they were there for a good long time on the other side, and they went through like a life review and saw the universe and everything like that. But then Jeff Hoots, like, just, it literally felt like, you know, a minute maybe.
Mm.
He was there, walked around, and boom, he's brought back, right? I think that's really interesting to me, just how diverse these experiences were, yet the outcome was still the same. And I can't account for that, why that would be.
Yes. I think these are the things, because when you start to dive into this subject, it is, for me, remarkable just how much on the fringes this has kind of skirted around science for 50, 60 years, because obviously it started to come into prominence in the sort of 50s and 60s, especially in North America with, I think, was it Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Raymond Moody were the two big proponents of near-death experiences through personal experiences and conversations that they were having. And obviously, as the 70s and 80s developed, Jason, more and more academics seem to be falling into two camps. You were either for it or against it. And therefore, they essentially just sort of did this near-death experience tango around each other, where they were just throwing counter-arguments at each other. And yet, the near-death experience, phenomena, culture, whatever you want to call it, seems to have grown out of the New Age explosion in the late 60s and sort of found a real niche, regardless of how people view it, that it seems to have gone away from those kinds of floaty ideas and perhaps people thinking it was just some crazy counterculture dream, to become something that some people really believe in it rigorously.
Well, they do. And it's almost, in a way, their own form of religion, the whole experience around it, right? And, you know, there's even whole societies where you could, you know, allegedly meditate and reach this other side just by changing your wavelength. Which, that to me is a pretty out there concept. You know, you mean I can just go there like anytime I want? Like, I have a hard time grasping that mentally, but the people who believe it so profoundly that I can't argue with them about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's becoming almost like this transcendental movement, you know, with the hope that it will, if enough people have these experiences and share their stories, that society will just start to change for the better. Which I find fascinating. So I think it still keeps a bit of that New Age-ness to it, but they're trying their best to get, I think, the science to back it up. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah,
by just bringing in people who are medical professionals who are willing to take a good, serious look at it. But still, the one argument that's big for the scientific side for it not being real is that these people haven't reached a point where their body has begun to go into rigor mortis and decompose, which is, that's the clinical term of death, right?
Yep.
So your brain is still somewhere firing and creating these experiences to help transition yourself to just non-existence anymore. So I'm not quite sure where I was going with that, but Paul, it's just this topic that we could talk about for episodes and episodes and episodes and still not really bring it into focus enough. And I think even just writing that book, there's a point where we just kind of had to stop.
Yeah.
And just let people make up their own minds about it. And all the stuff's still rattling around in my head even, and it's been out for almost 2 months now, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around what I wrote.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, like we said, though, these are enormous questions in the whole reality of what life is, regardless of your point of view. And I think the bit in the book where you are speaking with these people who claim to be able to reach these places through meditation, because I was never aware of that aspect of it, because for anybody from the outside, they would say, oh, well, this is an out-of-body experience or traveling the astral plane, perhaps, Jason. And then you begin to think, well, are these things all the same thing? Well, they've just got different names for them, depending on who's telling you about the experience or what, as you refer to there, their belief or their quasi-religious stance on it is. Because for a lot of people, they would all seem to be the same thing. They've just got a different name, really.
Well, and that's why I thought it, like, at first it was, we weren't going to include like the chapter with David Bettenhausen and Carla Bogney-Kidd about the past lives. But then hearing their story, it made perfect. It did. It's almost like you say, it was like, well, this is just a different way of explaining what was happening. Right. Cause they too, through meditation, could travel to past lives that they had lived.
Mm.
And they brought, I can't remember how many it was, like 16 or something like that. Different past lives where they'd interacted together.
Mm.
And shared. And then there's even a place like Between Lives, which very much fit into what, like, you know, Peter Panagore and Scott Taylor were talking about with like this life review and just being able to see the universe. Like, that's like the waiting point before going to another life. And even the one thing that really I found the most, it really hit me because it did tie into a bit of an experience I had, is when Peter was being sent back to his life, he's going down this tunnel with all these offshoot tunnels, which could be different lives he could choose to go to. And I had a moment once where I was found myself, I don't know if I was dreaming or what, having an out-of-body experience where I was in the same place where a voice told me, you can pick any life you want to go into now.
Huh.
You know, you have a choice. And that just, I remember that freaking me out. And then freaked me out even more when I heard that Peter had something similar happen to him after a near-death experience. So, you know, I just look at it as, you know, and then it ties into kind of the whole multiverse concept that's being bantered around a lot in the paranormal field. Like, maybe this all is just kind of one phenomenon with different names. And because we're looking at it from very different points of view with different theories behind it, that we're not seeing how it's all connected. And that's something when I finish writing the book that I'm still rattling around in my brain, but that's what's starting to make the most sense to me, is somehow all these experiences are in some way connected to one thing. And it's been with us since the dawn of humanity, and we just need to figure it out. That's kind of what I'm leaning towards having written this book.
Yeah, well, it's daunting for you, Jason, dealing with this subject, because of, you know, as you say, it would be very easy once again to kind of play to the audience and say that you had some kind of near-death experience. When you're speaking with people, and obviously having Peter alongside you, I would imagine always helps people buy into the fact that you want to talk about this subject, because they don't think you're going to criticize them or ridicule them. You're simply going to speak to them and let them tell their story. So were you daunted by approaching some of these people because you didn't have that? Or did you find it even more enthralling, the fact that people were talking to you about concepts and experiences that you hadn't experienced, and therefore you were probably less biased by the whole conversation?
Yeah, that's kind of the way I approached it. Like, I wasn't sort of daunted or put out by the idea. I was just fascinated and wanted to hear each person's story, and then see if that could help me formulate. Because I went into it not really, I wouldn't say I didn't believe that near-death experiences happen, because I'm open-minded about it, but not having had one, I had no baseline to compare it to, other than what Peter had told me. Like, I could write books on haunting, sure, because I've investigated them and lived in haunted houses, etc. And I've seen ghosts, you know, had that experience, but not having had a near-death experience, I just went in as this excited, open-minded person wanting to hear their stories. And then I figured I would also come to it with a bit of a skepticism too, to kind of keep things in check. And that's where I tried to put my voice in throughout the book, to kind of comment on it. And as I went along, I found myself believing more and more that these experiences were really happening and that these people, what they say happened to them. And so that then opened my point of view a bit more to this whole field, and started to allow me to formulate more of my thoughts on really how the universe works. If that makes sense. You know, the underlying theme became that there's a lot more going on, and we do not just die, we continue on.
Yeah.
In a different life, and then even on a different other side. And eventually, as we kind of correct our mistakes that we've made in our lives, we get to a more pure point, and then connect with, I guess, a divine entity or God, whatever you want to call it.
Yes. Yeah. Because obviously that's a whole different argument for different people, depending on how they view the whole phenomenon as well, which is something else that I think may surprise some people. But once again, I think this is sometimes the problem with this subject, is that people will come at it from a subconsciously biased point of view, regardless. And as you mentioned, Angela's experience, she was stating about how her concept of passing on was ingrained by her mother being an atheist, who just basically said, when you die, that's it, you've gone. And there's nothing else. And yet other people would come through it through their religious upbringing, be they Protestant or Catholic or numerous other religious denominations from around the world. And obviously, when you look towards more Eastern religions, a lot of them have this concept of transcending into a different life. And this is only part of the journey. And it's one of those parts of all this conversation I find fascinating about how we seem so reticent to be open about these subjects. As you say, it's we don't talk about funerals and things anymore. They're celebrations and wakes, and we try and look at it in a more positive. So I think we are slowly getting there, but I think we've got a lot to sort of catch up when it comes to, obviously, cultures such as Buddhism, which has a very sort of theoretical view on it all, and it all seems inconsequential. It's just, this is the vessel you're passing through this particular phase of the journey in.
Oh, absolutely. And as someone who I would closely label myself as more of a Buddhist than anything else, and I'm also very much a Stoic. In fact, I carry around this coin because the Stoics believe in this thing called memento mori. And that basic thing is, you could leave life right now. We were not guaranteed when we wake up in the morning that we're going to make it to the end of the day. And when we go to bed at night, there's no guarantee we're going to wake up. But we just take it for granted that we will, right? But we don't know that. And they look at it as, like you say, like what the people who have these near-death experiences are. Then that means you need to love more, live better, not worry about frivolous little things. So don't chase fame or fortune or not, because none of that means anything in the end. When you die, you don't take it with you. And I hope that we as a society move more towards that, because I think we've really become misguided in what the purpose of being here is. And I look at this sort of near-death movement, for lack of a better word, as almost being kind of the people on the frontier of that, really pushing that concept forward, that there is more to life, and that what how we're living now is not the right way to live, and we're missing the point of it all. Life is about love and connectedness and having these great experiences with people and you know, loving each other and being good to each other. So I look at it all, and that's a really positive way to look at dying, I think. You know what I mean? Like, it should encourage you to live better. Instead of just being scared of it and burying thoughts of it in a whole bunch of inconsequential BS.
Yeah.
But that's me ranting. But that's my biggest takeaway from the whole, 8 to 10 months we spent working on this book.
Have you found it refreshing? Because I found the introduction to this book quite challenging through your experiences as a crime reporter, Jason, and obviously a couple of the situations that you mention in the book. And I think it's one of those things that we often don't really take stock of when we hear people or consider the roles that some people have in this world of ours, that there will always have to be people like you found yourself for that period of time that have to report on some of the most gruesome aspects of humanity that's imaginable, really, even from self-inflicted injuries to murders and other horrific crimes. And so when I was reading that part of the book, I think it's one of those aspects, especially in this modern era of serial killer culture, especially, which is phenomenally successful on a variety of platforms. And as someone with a deep interest in serial killers, primarily because I just cannot get my head around what creates someone to be of that mindset in whatever way they build their brand, which I think is quite a churlish way of looking at it. But certainly some would like to promote themselves as more than who they are often. And there seems to be sometimes an over-celebration of some of these deeply evil people for some unknown reason. I think we forget the impact it has on people like yourself at that period of time, that when it is your job and you have to deal with it, when we think about police officers or doctors and nurses and medical technicians and ambulance drivers and paramedics, I think often we focus on the fact that they save people more often than not without looking at the ramifications of when they lose people or they're unable to do so. And so when you were pointing out the two particular incidents that really shook you based on the trauma that you'd had with your father's untimely passing as a young man, Jason, I think clearly when you've gone through this journey of having the conversations that you've had in this book, do you think it's kind of given you a more positive outlook on it? Because obviously by the point you'd finished being a crime reporter, you were obviously completely mentally and physically frazzled by the role you had.
Oh yeah, no, I was done. I was done. Like, I mean, it was, that was a rough 10 years really. And And I had a very cynical, I still kind of do have a very, you know, jaded and cynical outlook on things, but writing the book certainly softened that.
Yeah.
I mean, because once you experience those things, you don't just forget them.
Mm.
And you can't just pretend that the world's always a rosy, lovely place and then nothing bad ever happens. You become aware that, you know, at any moment, at any time, something terrible can happen and it's out of your realm of control. But what the book really helped is it helped me to do is focus on the things that I could control, which is my reactions to things, you know, loving my wife and son more, you know, appreciating the good friendships that I do have, letting go of the ones that were toxic or really not worth the time. You know what I mean? Like, it did help me to live better. Whereas I think it was 8 years between when the paper shut and basically when I was working on this book, there's a lot of time in there where to get out of that mindset of dealing with that day in and day out for so long, it just sours your POV of things.
Hmm.
So I think the book really helped kind of come through that and made me, and I became very scared of death too. Hmm. Having lost a father so young and worrying that I could go before, you know, my son is of an age to really handle it or be established in life where it's not so traumatic a loss or even having something horrible happen to him or my wife or someone else I love. Like, you kind of learn to let go of that fear because you can't do anything about it. And you focus just on appreciating what you have while you have it and living as good as possible, which again, tied into the whole takeaway for me from this book and what I hope people take away from it. This book in many ways saved my worldview a bit.
Good.
Which was awesome. I mean, that I did not anticipate at all.
Well, I suppose that makes it a very cathartic process as well, because grief is a strange thing. And I think often when we talk about these concepts, often, and as you say, when you were a young person, clearly the grief was just affecting you in a variety of things that you were bouncing around. You didn't know where you wanted to go. And you kind of just threw yourself into journalism, Jason. And I think anybody that's suffered a traumatic loss, be it a loved one, a family member, a close friend or whatever, it's very interesting how people deal with it. In regards to, some people just like to get their head down and get on with it. Some people, it takes them a long time to move forwards. And often we have, once again, in this modern era, we seem to have this kind of one size fits all for grief, that people will feel sad for a bit and then, yeah, you'll get on with it, it's fine. And it frustrates me that even in this modern era, people still seem to have this. Yeah, we've certainly moved away from that stiff upper lip nonsense that we used to have. And especially, I suppose, going forwards in the concepts of how we're very open about mental illness and the effects it can have on anybody, regardless of who you are, what you are, how much you have, it can still get you, whether you're aware of it or not. It will creep up on you like nobody's business. So when you sort of deal with these concepts, do you find that, as we were saying about some of the people that have had these experiences, it's completely altered the way they view their place in the world as well?
Oh, for sure. It completely, like, you know, Peter Panagor saying how he became much more eccentric. He became his true self. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, and I think everyone kind of comes out of it feeling more their true self.
Yes.
And I think, which is good, because why do we compromise just to make other people feel better? You know what I mean? You shouldn't go around being a jerk to everybody and,
yeah,
you know, punch people randomly on the street or smoke in places you shouldn't smoke or drink, yeah, and become rude. But
yeah,
why should you tone yourself down just because it makes other people uncomfortable? But usually if those other people are uncomfortable, it's because they wish they could be like you. Do you know what I mean? There's a time, Paul, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you because I wouldn't have written a book about it. And I wouldn't be so open about my interest in the paranormal. But I hit a point in life where I was like, screw that. Like, this is something I'm fascinated by and that I wanted to do for a living. And I'm fortunate to have found myself in a position to do. It makes some people uncomfortable, but then I don't associate with those people anymore.
Yeah.
Because why would I? And I found it refreshing that so many people in this book were just, they were who they were. They stated their beliefs and their opinions. And other than that, for the most part, they didn't really care what anybody else thought, including myself. And I found that great. Even Lawrence Ward, like the scientist, right? Like, he was just like, no, I don't think this is real. But I do believe we should live good lives. And in his own way, he was very spiritual about living life just while you had it. And I thought that was great that he was just so on the nose about that. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. I think, as you've just referred to, that I'm exactly the same, that I'm having this conversation with you through a very similar thing, that I got to a point in my life where it was sink or swim, Jason. It was going to take me one way or the other. And I was sick of trying to be what people, I thought people wanted me to be. And the last 4 years have been a completely different life. And it's one of those things you can look back and think, oh, well, I wish I'd done it 10 years ago. But I think sometimes you have to reach that point in your life that makes you make that decision before you can actually embrace your future with both hands, because otherwise you either don't achieve what you want to achieve, or you're not really being the person you should be. And like you say, you should never try and conform. And often people are afraid of sticking out. Once again, it's one of those things, safety in numbers. It's ingrained in human nature, for better or for worse, for a lot of people, that depending on how they went through school or life or their family, people don't want to be different. People feel afraid to be themselves until they move, or they get a new job, or they meet new friends or whatever, and suddenly they realize their true potential. And as long as you say, you can go forwards and be positive and carry yourself well, as you say, without being a jerk, then all power to you. Be who you want to be. It's the best thing you can do for your own sanity more than anything else.
Well, it is. People exhaust themselves trying to conform to other ideas. You know what I mean? Or other people's wishes, you know? And I mean, I find that really sad. And some people never break out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think social media, this is a different topic, but social media has made it even, in one hand, easier for people to be themselves and get themselves out there. But you're also, I think, as well, you're seeing how other people live, and it's not really the truth.
Yes.
Right? Like, I think it can hurt people more that, you're only seeing the good moments, right? And or hearing of the good moments. Few people get out and go on about the crappy day they had or whatever.
Yeah.
I think we're not quite there yet, but I think society as a whole is becoming better at being open to people just being themselves.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And I think the fact that we've got transgendered movement and the LGBTQ, which I think is pushing things a lot further that way, is great. No matter what your beliefs are politically or religiously or spiritually about any of that, I think they're making great headway for people to be who they want to be and express themselves as they need be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's important, I think, because these are all concepts which I think, unless you have these conversations, wouldn't really sort of tally with some of this, but I think they do, because often people find themselves in such traumatic situations, as you discuss in the book, that often we think, well, how can you move forward? And I think when you fly so close to this situation or deal with these topics, I think the only way you're ever going to be able to move forwards after you've experienced something on this level is to put one foot in front of the other and just step out and be proud of who you are.
Mm-hmm. No, that's, well said. That's exactly it. And don't let the negative stuff hold you down or hold you back.
Mm.
But too many people get caught up in their grief and never, my mother never did get over the loss of her husband of 33 years. You know what I mean? And it just ruined her life in the end, to the point where the last 10 years of her life were absolutely miserable. She became a miserable person to be around. Because she couldn't just, you need more than, what is it that most work gives you, 3 to 5 bereavement days and that's it? You need more than that.
Yeah.
a lot more than that. It can take years.
Yes.
But at a certain point, you have to want to move past these things. And it took me a long time to get to the point where I wanted to, but I'm glad I did. And I try to, as other people I know who go through hard times, that's my encouragement to them. It's like, you got to live in that grief. You got to feel it. You got to acknowledge it. You can't deny it. But if you allow yourself to live in it, eventually it just gets easier.
Yeah.
And you do move forward. As long as you don't dwell, you can live in it and feel it, but just don't dwell on it.
Mm.
And that's, the best advice I can give anybody who goes through anything, and find people to talk to.
Yes.
Like the right people to talk to. Right.
Yeah.
Not your drinking buddies, which they're fine, someone professional who's trained to do that kind of thing, which is why we included, the interview with Jolene Lindsay, who's a grief and trauma counselor. Her point of view is so important, I think, to have especially in a book about near-death experiences and death in general.
Well, exactly. I think it's important not to underestimate that aspect of it all, because regardless of the positive outlooks that the people in the book have, these are still very traumatic experiences. And I found this subject seems to be one of those that seems to transcend celebrity culture as well, because you don't have to go far on the internet to find numerous celebrities from all walks of life, from all professions throughout the last 50 or 60 years, Jason. Some very, very famous people have claimed to have had near-death experiences, and some of them have found it extremely cathartic. Some of them, it's completely changed their life. One of the ones that's always really surprised me was Sharon Stone, who had a stroke and managed to sort of, she claimed that she saw the light and she was going to it, and then she was pulled away. And it's very interesting how this is one of those particular subjects, along with hauntings, I think, where people in certain parts of society are very open about these conversations because they seem to find them, you can clearly tell that something deeply profound has happened to these people because they clearly don't care what you mm-hmm. think they're saying. Because 50 years ago, an actress of the level of Sharon Stone coming forward and saying, oh yeah, well, I nearly died and I went to the light and then I was told that it wasn't my time and I came back. People would be like, okay. All right.
Killer career.
Yeah.
That would be the end of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And yet you can now find hundreds of stories and first-hand accounts from these people, from, like I say, actors, musicians, authors, historians, scientists, doctors, as we've touched on in some of the people involved in this movement of the exploration of the whole near-death experience phenomenon, Jason, that it's one of those things that clearly when it happens to you, you just go, if you're fortunate enough to come back, you just go, well, I don't care what you think. This is what's happened to me, and it's changed my life for the better.
Well, I think that's, even hearing it like with other realms of the paranormal, it was Jerry Garcia talked about his UFO encounter.
Yes.
Recently. And I think that just shows how, even though the near-death experiences are sort of maybe more controversial, say, than a ghost or a UFO, because UFOs are it right now. They're all the rage. The fact that we've been hearing these conversations in media just shows where the world's going.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's no longer, you used to only hear ghost stories and UFO stories at Halloween.
Yes.
And now, I mean, it's everywhere all the time in various media. And I think that's awesome. I think that just shows we are slowly becoming more open-minded as a society and as a culture. And I like that. And yeah, and when you hear, like, I didn't know about Sharon Stone's story. I think that's amazing that she just came out and talked about it like it was nothing. And I think that's great. I think more, sadly, the more celebrities like that who do that, it lends it more credence. Right? Because it's people who are worshipped by culture.
Absolutely.
more than the average Joe, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I think that's amazing that we're getting there.
Yeah.
Slowly but surely.
When you were speaking with these people, Jason, did you come across anybody else that's had these experiences? Because I love these stories of people that have had near-death experiences where they meet people they either don't expect or don't want to meet, who apparently say, oh no, I'm here to kind of tell you it's not your time to go back. And as we were talking about celebrities, Elizabeth Taylor's always had my favorite one of these, where I think she was having an operation and she was under anesthetic and she just started floating off to the light, and her third husband, who'd passed away, turned up. And she said, oh, if any of my husbands were going to turn up, I never thought it'd be him. So, and he convinced her to go back, and she did, because he said, you've got a lot of life left to live, so you need to go back and keep fighting. And she went back. But I always find those ones quite amusing when you read these experiences or hear these people talk about it, where they come across complete strangers or people they wouldn't expect to be that person saying, no, it's not your time, you've got to go back. Are you surprised at the number of those? Because often when we talk about the whole near-death experience, often it's a perception, a cliche even, Jason, that it'll be a loved passed on relative or a dear friend that's moved on that's going to be there to kind of save you from floating off wherever they go and following the light or becoming, as some of the concepts you were discussing in the book, part of this omnipresent source or this mind connection that some people seem to believe is the answer to what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like Mary Helen Hensley, where she was talking that it was just a couple of senior citizens that came out and met her, right? And she wasn't really aware, but she kind of clued in that these were, like, you know, because people talk about that you have your spirit guides that are supposed to help you along. That's in some belief circles. And that, I think that's who these people are, be it if someone you know or someone you don't know. They're just your spirit guide or your angel, whatever you want to call it, that's just there to kind of helping you, nudging you along the way. And I think that's even what Angela Artuso thought her Man in Black was, right? Even though he was freaky.
Yeah.
That was someone that was there kind of helping her out. So it didn't really surprise me that people would see people they didn't know or just an anomalous shape kind of thing, because it just tied into the kind of what I'd heard, you know, about, or even just what people believe in terms of spirituality, having these other influences there. guiding us along from time to time. And then when you hear that, heard that it was someone that they knew, well, that made sense too, because of course it would be someone who you would know, right? At the same time, I think it shows again how subjective these experiences are.
Mm. And it also gives strength to the argument that this isn't this cultural pollination of ideas. Because I know in the chapter you're speaking with, when you're speaking with Lawrence Ward, it's one of the most thought-provoking pieces of writing I've read in quite a while, because he's clearly very skeptical about this whole phenomenon, and he dives into the whole clinical explanation of what death is, and it's quite gory, some of the bits where he's telling you how they make sure you are dead and what they do to people just to make sure that there's definitely nothing going on, which is one of those things that makes you think, oh goodness, I don't want to come back if somebody's doing that to me. But
no.
it's also really interesting that when we have this kind of situation, as you were saying earlier on about it, we can't agree to disagree. Ward, despite the fact that he's extremely skeptical and provides numerous scientific evidence and explanations for what he believes is happening here and why these people aren't dead, he's still very spiritual and positive and progressive in his mind view and the way he thinks people should be, which I found probably one of the politest and most positive skeptical arguments against the near-death experience phenomenon that I've ever read.
Oh yeah, no, he was amazing. Like I felt so lucky that we could talk to Lawrence, because he was just, you just summed his chapter up perfectly, right? Like he's basically saying, no, you're wrong, but he's saying it in the nicest possible way. And his message is still one of being a good human being, right? And making the most of your life. I thought he was, I'm so glad that could be in the book, his chapter. It just fit with the tone of how everything was, yet he definitely provided that like skeptical point of view, but he presented it in a way, like you say, that you weren't like offended by the end of it. You're like, oh, okay, what a nice guy, you know, kind of thing. It was nice to have that there. And I think it's refreshing to hear, because usually the skeptics are just like, no, you're wrong and you're stupid.
Yeah.
And he was the complete opposite of that. And it was, we need more Lawrence Wards in the scientific community, I think. I think if that happens, I think you'll eventually find the scientific community taking this whole realm of paranormal high strangeness a lot more seriously, even if they don't believe it.
Mm. And I think it ties into the concepts we often have when it comes to the arguments for and against certain phenomenon in regards to how people view the power of the brain. Because one of the biggest misconceptions is that people say, well, we only use 10% of our brains. And I used to think that till I once saw a neurologist explain that even in the art of making a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, you essentially use all parts of your brain, because different parts of it are firing up and sending signals all over the place. And you know what you're doing and why you're doing it and how to do it and everything. And everything's working. And the concept isn't that we only use 10% of our brains. We only know how 10% works, which is a different thing.
I agree. Yeah, because I mean, we have to use more of our brain than what we're thinking. Because think of what we do on a daily basis, like you and I even having this conversation, running. You're able to run your computer and recording equipment. I'm sitting here running all my stuff, listening to you, trying to think up a good answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've not spilled my drink on myself. There's a lot going
right,
on.
You know, and then the text message comes through. They say, you know, letting me know something's about to happen. And it's just, there's so much that I think we use the brain, so many parts of the brain, but we're just not tapping into it in a way that we understand, if that makes sense. And I'm sure if these are just created by something in the brain, who's to say that whatever's creating them doesn't just tie it into this other side anyways? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
To you? Like, sure, maybe the brain is just firing in a certain way to make our transition not painful and not frightening.
Hmm.
But who's to say that that also doesn't send us over to this other plane of existence?
Perhaps.
We just don't know yet, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we know enough about how the brain works that anybody that's had a traumatic experience, often people will say that it's been pushed away or changed. And as you mentioned earlier, we talk about things like alien abductions and people consider the whole concept of screen memories and the like, Jason. And yet, we all know people that have gone through traumatic incidents in their life, be it a car accident or a serious injury at home or playing sports or whatever, and there are certain aspects of the whole event that they can't remember for whatever reason. And more often than not, as we've developed our understanding of trauma and the way the brain tries to protect us, it's a self-defense mechanism. It's suppressing that to look after us. Often we kind of think that, oh, well, you've got a bad memory. Whereas we now know it's self-preservation. It's just trying to look after us.
It is. Yeah, it is a defense mechanism of our body. Like I had a pretty bad car accident, one that, you know, when I was at the paper, that people I knew in the fire department said I shouldn't have walked away from, but I did. Mm-hmm. But I remember losing control and then waking up with the airbag in my face.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I can vaguely remember a crunch, you know, kind of thing as the vehicles collided.
Yeah.
But that's really it. And as time has gone on, I remember less and less. And it was just, it is a way just to kind of protect yourself, you know, so that you can just kind of keep on going. And this is kind of an example. I remember talking, I had an uncle who I loved dearly pass away. And when I phoned my aunt to offer condolences at the end, you know, when she was sort of talking to him, and he was just very calm and very peaceful and just said, just let me go. Just let me go. I'm ready. You know what I mean? Like something made him just, he wasn't scared at that moment. He was at peace. And I think our bodies and our minds protect us, like you said, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just our body's natural defense mechanism. Same with fight or flight, kicking in, knowing if you want to stand your ground or run.
Yeah.
We are amazing machines, and we're very good at self-preservation in whatever form that needs to take.
Mm. Do you think this is also tied in with some of these other strange reports that we get often when people are ready to pass over? Because one of the interesting aspects of all this is that I think, as Lawrence Ward was referring to, we'll never really know what happens, because with the greatest respect, most people who are seriously ill aren't saying, oh, but if you want to attach electrodes to me so you can measure my brain waves as I'm passing away. It's not something that we've really got the facility to measure, is it? Let's be honest here. So it's always going to be a very personal experience that's kind of removed from scientific endeavor, as it were. And yet, once again, I think one of the other aspects of this whole concept of the other side, or people moving to whatever they believe it be, the light, often is more commonly put forward as where people believe they are going, Jason. These experiences where people will visit relatives in hospital who are at close to passing, and they'll start to talk about visitors coming to see them, or passed on relatives have come to guide them to wherever they are. For me, I think these are, they're not exactly the same, but there's clearly some similar kind of concept here, that we've got these reports, and many medical practitioners have also reported that sometimes as people are passing away, strange things seem to be going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it makes you wonder, like, are these past relatives actually really coming?
Mm.
Right? As someone who's a paranormal investigator, I go with, yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And, you know, it's the same when you have small children that say they have their imaginary friend or they're seeing things.
Yes. Yes.
I think they really are. And I think just as we get older, you're told that, no, if you talk about that, that's wrong, right? It gets churched out of you and schooled out of you, et cetera. And then when you kind of become older and no longer really care so much, you see these things again and you're willing to talk about it. So I think that just gives further credence to there being more going on around us paranormally, for lack of a better word. And I think as you get closer to death, you kind of become more in tune with that. Once again, especially if you were someone who wasn't inclined to believe that before, I think it becomes irrefutable. I've known people in the last, you know, month before death where they started seeing things in their house, reliving past experiences, almost like they were there again, which brings the whole concept of, you know, time not being linear. And I think it's just fascinating. My mother, like in the weeks before she died, she said she was seeing people around her house all the time who were not, you know, she was the only one at home, and she was seeing other people in the house all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think she was hallucinating. I think she was seeing what's around us all the time anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe it's that concept of as people are preparing to make the transition, that as we've said about this concept of the veil, or however you want to view it, on a transdimensional point, or the concept of the brain working in a different way, whatever's going on, it's very similar to, as you say, about how children aren't programmed to not see these things. And obviously, some of the experiences that children refer to, some of them are deeply, deeply unsettling, Jason.
Hugely.
Probably more often the stories I hear from parents who say that their children are telling them about their special friends that they've got that nobody else can see. Some of them are really close to the knuckle for me and a bit, probably more frightening than the most experiences I've heard from adults, I would suggest.
Oh, big time. I remember my son telling me that there was two spirits that lived in our house. One who was downstairs, but at the moment it was at work, wherever work was. Another one that liked to live in the walls and torment the dog. I was like, oh, okay.
Just very matter of fact.
Going on in this house. So I was like, okay, that makes perfect sense to me. Like, wow, kid. I suddenly am unentitled.
we're visiting the estate agents tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why have you brought 3 kilograms of sage home, Jensen? What's going on?
Exactly, right? And garlic. But I didn't doubt him for a moment. You know, it just made sense.
Well, it is one of those things. I'm very interested in things like that. Because once again, a lot of children sometimes talk about things that really 3- and 4-year-olds should have absolutely no concept of whatsoever, even in the modern era where they've got access to information and the internet. You know, let's be brutally honest, I find it very hard to believe that 3- and 4-year-olds are watching programs about serial killers and browsing the internet for these subjects.
Oh yeah, no. they're not. You know, maybe where my son's almost 11 and they're kind of into this stuff now.
Yeah.
So him and his buddies look for it, but not at 3 and 4. They're watching, you know, he was watching like this kid stuff on YouTube and TV, right? So
I found one of the interesting chapters that once again is something that perhaps gets overlooked in this was the concept of the shared death experience, Jason. Mm-hmm. Did you find that interesting? Because often, especially when we talk about the paranormal, there will be thousands of reports of people who know that someone's passed or someone has passed on and they've been visited by that particular person. But this one doesn't really fall into either of those categories, does it? It's a very, very unique experience that's explained.
It was, and I'd never heard of a shared death experience before talking to Scott. So it took me really by surprise. It was weird. Like, I'm listening to him tell his story, and it's very emotional. Mm-hmm. And he was very emotional telling it. We actually had to do it in 2 separate interviews.
Yeah.
But, and part of me, like, listening to him, and I feel bad for admitting it, but I'm like, this guy's crazy. Like, you know, in my head, there's that skeptic part of me. He's just like, there's no way. But the other part of me is like, but he's so honest and emotional and invested in this that I can't not believe him. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was, seemed I'm believing what he's telling me. And it was, yeah, I'd never heard of one before that, nor in anyone else we were interviewing, but just the fact that he could be taken into this transition, but not, you know, and then come back while watching, you know, someone else die. It was mind blowing. And then to have, you know, I interviewed him first, and like a few weeks later, I interviewed Peter Panagore, and a lot of what Scott Taylor was talking about when he had a shared death experience fit in with what Peter had during his near death experience with, you know, the life review center and, you know, the beings. And yeah, it was just, so it lent credence to Scott's story too. I don't know what to make. I understand now, having done a little further research, there's a very small part of the near death experience is the shared death experience phenomenon, but it's very rare. And I wonder how many people you'd actually come across who would have it or even understood what was happening to them.
Yeah.
The big takeaway is that in this moment of incredible grief, he's feeling this great joy. He's even hiding his face because he was afraid other people would look and see him smiling. Mm-hmm. At this moment when this child, you know, of like, you know, I can't remember 8 or 9 or something, had just died. And he's just having this euphoric moment because he's, you know, reunited with his girlfriend, Mary Fran, and he's going to the other side and realizing it's not so bad. It's actually quite, quite good. And feeling all this, what he calls exquisite joy. You know, it's just like, holy cow, it changes your whole perspective of dying.
Yeah.
Really. It was just so different than anything I'd heard about at that point. Because he was one of the earlier interviews too for the book.
Yeah. Would you say that was probably the most challenging conversation you had in
for sure. Book? For sure. Right. I'm just even trying to, like, you know, I kind of just really let him tell it and didn't try to interject too much until after. And like I said, it was in two interviews. So by the time we got to the second one, I was a lot better equipped mentally to talk about it because I was just taken and blown away. Like I said, I wasn't believing it at first, but it was kind of in a way won over just by his honesty and his emotionality in telling this experience.
Yeah.
But it was very challenging, but it really prepared me for other interviews as well.
Yeah.
And just how kind of quote unquote far out some of these experiences can go.
Mm. I think it is surprising sometimes when we speak with people or we read or hear certain aspects of any of the variety of phenomena that make up the paranormal, Jason, that occasionally there will be certain aspects to it that take us back or shock us even. Or once again, I'm often surprised with certain investigators who will not discuss certain facets to a case or certain cases that they're investigating because it doesn't fit what they believe their interpretation of what's going on is happening. And I'm sure this is something you've come across previously, but I found it refreshing to see that that was included because it was a very challenging situation that he was discussing. And often when we come across different aspects of it, whether it be cryptozoology or ufology or hauntings, there seems to be certain things that people don't want to cover or don't want to talk about or simply don't give it credence. And I often think that it's quite remarkable when we think about the subject matter that we're discussing, that we have a credibility level. I mean, there are some things that, you know, I'll be brutally honest, there are some things I will not give the time of day. However, I've yet to see anybody that can prove they've been a secret space soldier on Mars. you know, if anybody tells me they can jump 20 foot in the air, I want to see them do it. Because if you say you can do it, then show me. It's as simple as that.
And I'll believe you.
Yeah. I've never seen anybody. Why aren't you in the Olympics?
Well, you should be in Olympics, you know, yeah, or the time traveler from the year 3000 who comes back and on TikTok. Right? Like, yeah, but you can't. It's like the whole paranormal Bigfoot thing. Like, why would you not take that into consideration, right? And so why not take into consideration a shared death experience? Who's to say? Because we don't know.
No, I'm a big proponent of when we're talking about certain things like cryptids, why is nobody discussing the concept of ghosts in conjunction with cryptids? So sometimes these people say, oh, well, it just disappeared. What, you mean like a ghost did?
Yeah.
But nobody mentions that. It's got to be interdimensional. Well, if we're considering that aspect of it, why is nobody saying, well, have you not thought it might have been a ghost?
Yeah, a ghost of a Bigfoot. Because why not? We don't know, right? Like, if they die, their energy's got to go somewhere too, if they're a flesh and blood creature.
Precisely. And the world of the paranormal is filled with stories of ghost animals.
Oh, yeah, ghost cats. I know people who've seen them. Yeah, I've seen them, you know, hurt them. Like, it's just, yeah. So I think that's one thing with this whole subject matter is, like, all cards should really be on the table. To a greater degree than people are willing to do that. But for some reason, if you think that Bigfoot's only flesh and blood, you discount every other possibility. Same with the UFO connection. You know what I mean? Like, you just, yeah, I don't understand that. I don't understand why the different facets, the ghost hunters can't get along with the cryptozoologists. They don't get along with the ufologists. That doesn't make sense to me either, because we're all after the same thing in the end. Just answers, right? Like, but it's like little high school cliques out there.
Well, exactly. And I think often when we're talking about these subjects, as with anything, Jason, why does it have to be a one-size-fits-all? We know enough, especially with your experience in ghost investigations and the paranormal. Every haunting is very different, isn't it?
Oh, no two are alike. Even if it's like a residual haunting, no two are alike. No two investigations are the same. Everything is its own unique experience. And even within when we talked about this before, even if you're investigating a haunting, each individual experience within that haunting is unique unto itself. And has to be looked at separately. That's the only way, I think, to do a thorough investigation.
I think the last chapter I'd like to touch on is obviously the whole conversation you have with Lynn Russell, who's obviously very famous for the work she did with Jeffrey Long. And I think for me, this part of it as well is simply the volume of cases that they investigated.
Oh, yeah.
But also, once again, this is one of those conversations where when I'm reading it, I thought it was going to go in a completely different direction to where it ended up.
Where did you think it was going to go, Paul?
Well, I thought we were going to end up going into this religious, it's either light or dark, heaven and hell. And when you read it and start to go through it, then the whole concepts of heaven and hell are really sort of broken down into the fact that this is what we were going to about how certain people view these experiences based on their preconceived ideas, their biases, their upbringings, their beliefs, Jason. So I was really interested to see how Lynn sort of deconstructed some of these perceptions or some of these experiences in a really interesting manner.
Well, it's interesting because that whole conversation went that way. Because it to me seemed like the most interesting part. Does that make sense?
Mm.
And as we were sort of talking about all our different cases and all that, I mean, we got into talking about how some people were dead for 12, 24 hours kind of thing and that kind of stuff. But just the fact that she really, and it was just through the, I don't remember exactly how she did it, but just that she broke down how these have been going on forever, these near-death experiences and all these other unexplainable things. And that really, from her mind, is why, and back, at the dawn of our species, we couldn't understand how these things work. We had no concept. And so we created these beliefs to explain it, to make sense out of it.
Yeah.
Make sense out of death and why people died and why crops failed. We created gods and devils and things like that. And to me, as someone who's not a religious person, is more spiritual, it made just perfect sense that, that's kind of the paranormal is as natural as life. And in order to understand it, we created our own religions and spiritual belief systems to better explain it.
Mm.
And that's just really how that kind of went along. And there's nothing so much any of the experiences she talked about that really set that forward, other than talking about her own belief, and just wanting to understand what happened when people die.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's really just how it kind of, that's just how the conversation went. And I found that the most, someone would even just talk that way.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you don't counteract religion. People are doing it more and more, but it just made perfect sense to me. Especially someone who didn't really grow up belonging to any one particular religion.
Mm.
My parents were Protestant, from a Protestant family. But we never practiced, right? I just knew people who were Catholic and of various different religions, but it just, none of them really made sense.
Yeah.
I tried a bunch of different ones for it to make sense, but it just didn't. But the way Lynn presented it, just said, wow, that made sense to me.
Yeah.
It really did. That's one other part that really came out of writing this book, is it changed my whole view of religion and spirituality too.
Hmm. I think it's always good when people can take a step back and look at things calmly and coolly, because it's one of those concepts, like when we talk about people who consider the reality of giants living on the earth. And you think, well, if we have to be brutally honest, people didn't know dinosaurs existed till 200 years ago. So I can kind of really comprehend that 500 years ago, if somebody found a giant thigh bone in a cliff, they're not going to think it's an enormous bird lizard, are they? They're going to think it's a giant person. So I find that people seem to have this concept that I find it surprising that people don't understand how recent the discovery and understanding of dinosaurs is in the whole concept of history.
I don't think people realize how young science is.
Yeah.
Either, really. No. And it's become everything that people are relying on. But man, this thing's new.
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things. Yeah. And people scoff at spiritualists, etc., but people relied a lot more on spiritualists than they did on scientists for the longest time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Never mind, there's so many hoaxes and stuff like that, but it just, people did. There were stories written about it in newspapers. It was like the front page news.
Absolutely. I mean, you used to get plagues and people would walk around sniffing flowers.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't go, that only works so far, I find.
It does. Exactly. That wouldn't have flown in the last couple of years.
No, not with the amount of people who've got hay fever.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Well, I have to congratulate yourself and Peter on a deeply thought-provoking, challenging, and yet incredibly positive book, Jason. I think it's one of the few books I've read on this subject that offers arguments from both sides of the divide, that offers us unbiased experiences with critical analysis and explanations of the scientific phenomenon and what they believe is going on. And I think it's for anybody who's interested in spirituality, the concepts of our own mortality, and the positive changes that trauma can bring people and how we move forwards, it would be a worthy addition to anybody's bookshelf.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. That's the best praise we've had heaped on our book so far, and I really appreciate it. I'm glad that it touched yourself that way. That was kind of our hope, that that's what people would take away from it.
Absolutely. I think it's a very challenging subject, and it was refreshing to read a book as balanced and unbiased as this, because as I said at the beginning of the conversation, it's very easy to fall into either camp or try and have a mishmash where you you're trying to play to the audience or not upset anybody. And there are obviously completely conflicting points of view in this book, which are put there in the spirits that they're meant, as we mentioned about Lawrence Ward, who is deeply skeptical, but extremely polite about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lawrence is amazing. I can't say that enough. I just, he's almost one of the interviews that blew me away because I just didn't expect that.
Absolutely. So what's next for yourself and Peter? What's in the pipeline? And I know you've obviously got another project being planned and worked upon, no doubt.
Well, yeah, we're continuing with We Want to Believe, you know, our series, and we've got a number of them now that we can get out a lot easier. We've got a number of different investigations going on. Then we're continuing with our Bigfoot research as well on the show. And then, yeah, we are working on another book. We've got one more in the contract for Beyond the Fray, and we're going to focus on residential hauntings, focus on various residential hauntings that Peter's investigated, we're going to break down how we approach a residential haunting, because it's different than any other kind of haunting, how we approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And just talk some of the methodology and get into some case studies. So that's something we're going to start writing here in the fall. And if all goes well, it should be out by early next year. And then we're writing nothing.
It's taking a break.
Yeah.
So it'll be 4 books in 2 years, and that's a lot.
Yeah. You know? It's time to sit back and enjoy it. Pour yourself a hefty glass of your favorite whiskey, no doubt, sir.
Absolutely. That's my go-to.
Where can everybody follow your work and get a hold of the copy of the book?
Well, the book is currently out on Amazon, any Amazon in the world, and also through Beyond the Fray Publishing as well. And then people can always, you know, keep up with what Peter and I are doing on Facebook at the Canadian Paranormal Foundation, and We Want to Believe the series as well.
Fabulous. Jason, it's been too long since we spoke. Once again, congratulations to yourself and Peter on a wonderful book. And I wish you the very best, and hopefully we will speak again in the future, probably about some residential hauntings.
I think that's a great idea, Paul. I look forward to it already.
Take care, my friend.
You as well.